Record as well.
Yes, we're live.
Okay, wonderful. We would like to welcome everyone who is joining us tonight. Please give us just one more minute to get started. We are currently live both on Zoom and on Facebook, and we want to thank everyone for joining us. Let's just make sure that we are all set on both ends. Okay, wonderful. I think we can get started. Bismillah. Good evening, everyone. My name is Ahmet Selim Tekilioğlu. I'm the Education Outreach Director at CARE Philadelphia. And I'm joined tonight by my wonderful colleague, Raviel Chaudhry from Muslim Aid Initiative, one of our local leaders. And we are honored to be joined by two Kashmiri Americans, two individuals who have given a lot of passionate energy, years of research and advocacy to this issue. We are joined by Dr. Hafsa Kanjwal, who is an assistant professor in the history department at Lafayette College in Lehigh Valley. Good evening, Dr. Kanjwal. Thank you for joining us. And we are also joined by one of our local Philadelphia-based Kashmiri Americans, Dr. Sabina Fazili, who is a medical doctor, a poet, and an advocate for the Kashmiri cause. We are doing this program as part of our ongoing series of webinars. And CARE Philadelphia is a Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization. And one of the things that we do is we take seriously the passionate subjects that the community is concerned about and connect them to ongoing advocacy efforts. We see that as part of our civic engagement, as part of our duty to speak truth to power, especially when it comes to issues that impacts our community, whether that be injustice within our own neighborhoods in Philadelphia, or whether that be issues that are dear to the hearts of our community members. And as many of you might know, many of our community members have been following the Kashmir, the situation in Kashmir and the developments in India that impact Kashmir with heightened concern. And we have had several public meetings in and around Philadelphia area, and we wanted to take this opportunity to talk to experts and advocates around it in a way, in a manner to both get informed and at the same time get motivated to act. So we wanted to thank again our speakers for giving their valuable time to us, and many thanks once again to Brother Raviel for being my partner in crime and my dear colleague. So we want to get started with just one reminder, which is that we want to make this an interactive program. So please, please do not hesitate to post your questions either on the CARE Philadelphia and Muslim Aid Initiative Facebook feeds in the comment section, where we'll be monitoring and posting questions to our speakers. And at the same time, if you are joining us on Zoom in under the Q&A button, you can post your questions. So with that, we will get started quickly with the first question that I will direct to Dr. Kanjwal for her to sort of walk us through a 101 of Kashmir. What isn't in a name? We hear Kashmir, Jammu Kashmir, Azad Kashmir, kind of 101 of the conflict. How is Kashmir connected to settler colonialism? How did Kashmiri movement for self-determination respond to this, especially now that we are experiencing a Hindu nationalist government under Prime Minister Modi in India? If you can walk us through this long, complex history, we'll be very grateful.
Sure, thank you. Firstly, thank you so much to you both for inviting both of us to speak. It's really an honor. So I will try to give a brief overview in as short of a time I can, trying to cover several centuries of history. I am a historian, so unfortunately I will have to make you deal with that. Is it possible to get the map up of the region first? Yeah. So just kind of introductory remarks, Kashmir is often talked about in very kind of territorial terms. or as a dispute between India and Pakistan. And of course it is that, but it is much more. Historically, you know, for centuries, it has been kind of its own entity, its own sovereign entity. And then subsequently was a part of the Mughal Empire, the Sikh kingdoms, and then the Dogar kingdom. And then finally, during the time of the partition of India and Pakistan, that is where kind of Kashmir's modern history begins. But one of the important things for everyone to know is that this is a place that has its own unique history. It's at the crossroads of multiple civilizations, not just South Asia, but even interestingly, East Asia, with a region called Ladakh that is connected to Tibet and China, with Central Asia connected kind of historically to Afghanistan, the Silk Route, Iran, and so on. And then, of course, South Asia as well, which is kind of where it is more, you know, seen as today. And for really centuries, Kashmiris have been struggling to have kind of a sense of their own sovereignty and rule. And this self-determination movement that we talk about doesn't really just start in 1947 when India and Pakistan were created, but actually has a much longer history of Kashmiris striving to have better control over their economy, over their political situation. But because, you know, we don't have time to go into all of that, what happened at the time of the partition of the Indian subcontinent, some of you may be familiar with that history, Muslim majority states of the Indian subcontinent became a part of Pakistan, and Hindu majority states were to be with India. And Kashmir was a unique kind of place where a majority of the population was Muslim, but it was ruled by a Hindu Dogra Maharaja at the time, who initially would have preferred independence or some kind of independent setup, but then later on became, you know, because there was an uprising in the region of Jammu, which was part of his kingdom, of Jammu Muslims, he turned to the government of India for military assistance. And India basically let him know that they would give him assistance as long as he acceded to India. So all of that kind of happened under very murky terms. This ruler didn't really have the popular sovereignty, you know, or the he wasn't representing the will of the people. But that is what happened. And the Indian army basically came in. And Pakistan had earlier already, you know, sent certain tribes from the Northwest region that had come to liberate Kashmir's Muslims from the Maharaja. And then subsequently, India and Pakistan both went to war. So this map that you see today, or that you see ahead of you, is basically the area in the pink is the entire princely state of Jammu and Kashmir as it existed under the Dogras. And then it's split up after 1947. So the area in the green, which includes northern areas, which are today called Gilgit-Baltistan, as well as Azad Kashmir, that's controlled by Pakistan. And then the area in the, like, I guess the orange is Jammu and Kashmir, which is kind of the where much of the, you know, the focus of the conflict is, and that's occupied by India. And then there are parts that are largely uninhabitable that are controlled by China, called Aksai Chin. So three countries, three nuclear powers, obviously all, you know, being involved in this region. After India and Pakistan first went to war in 1947, in 1948, India actually took the issue to the United Nations, and the UN called for a plebiscite, meaning some kind of referendum on Kashmir's future. And at that time, it would have either meant India or Pakistan. That referendum has never taken place. And to this day, it's ultimately what the people of the region are demanding and calling for. After 1947, the part of Kashmir that was controlled by India became, you know, India tried to integrate it completely. It had given a promise of autonomy to the Kashmir's leadership at the time, enshrined in something called Article 370, where it would still be a part of India, but have significant autonomy to have its own constitution and its own set of laws and et cetera. And that is what was taken away last last August when Modi basically revoked Kashmir's special status. And since 1947, you know, the region has kind of been forcibly integrated into India. There's been more wars between India and Pakistan. In the late 1980s, there was a massive uprising that also resulted in an armed uprising against Indian rule. And that is when the intense militarization of Kashmir happened, with over 700,000 soldiers that were, you know, that became a part and parcel of daily life there, committing vast, you know, human rights atrocities, which I believe we'll be talking about in a bit as well. Kashmir remains the most militarized zone. And today, what is really frightening is that even though India has occupied it for all of this time and tried to forcibly incorporate it and deny the people their right to self-determination, now what the Kashmiris face under this Hindu nationalist government is a complete kind of existential crisis, where the government is trying to change the demography of the region, and they've already started. They're trying to make it so that Indian Hindus in particular can settle into the region and change the numbers, right? Because currently it has a Muslim majority, but once you settle in Indian Indians who were previously not able to buy land or property, that changes the demography. And so any kind of future resolution is then put into question or undermined. And so that's what we're really facing today, is, you know, some kind of process in which the region is going to be even more militarized, settlements will take place. And of course, we know that the Modi government and India is inspired by Israel as well. So what is happening is in Palestine is a model for them. And yeah, that is why, you know, we should all be extremely concerned, because any kind of settler colonial process necessarily entails the ethnic cleansing of the people, that the indigenous people that live there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kashmir.
Thank you, Dr. Hafsa, for the excellent history on Kashmir. Our next question is for Dr. Sabina. Human rights violations have been reported in many places in the world, extensively in Kashmir. Could you please give us some idea about what's happening in Kashmir, and how did August 5th change everything?
Yes, so assalamu alaikum, peace unto all. Thank you very much for hosting all this, and it's such a pleasure to meet Hafsa finally. So I would like to actually start without harping too much on my own bandwagon about who I am and all that. I would just like to give a little intro, because I want people to know literally where I'm coming from with this. And again, thank you so much for giving Kashmiris a voice, because usually what we see happening around us is that it's somebody from other countries talking about our future and about and trying to represent, or should I say misrepresent us. So thank you so much for giving, Kashmiri voice to this issue. So real quick, I was born in Kashmir of Kashmiri parents and lineage, and I greatly cherish Kashmiri heritage and culture to this day. I'm here for Kashmir and Kashmiris and humanity at large. I've lived in the valley of Kashmir through part of this upsurge of oppression. So I have witnessed it 101. And that's the reason why I feel the pain of those who suffered and are still suffering all the human rights violations and all that that we'll be talking about in a little bit. In addition to that, I have traveled and lived in different parts of the world. Hence, I'm very fortunate to have a bird's eye view in addition to an inside perspective. And I really thank Allah for that. So as a physician, I preserve humanity. And as a speaker, I enhance clarity, hopefully. As a poet, I vent while maintaining sanity, because, you know, there's so much conflict going on inside each one of us, because we know what the reality is, and yet we have to live our lives, you know, facing it. So, and the fourth thing is an advocate. As an advocate, I stand in solidarity with the oppressed. So having said that, you know, human rights violations, it's like, where do we start? Hafsa knows much better than I do about that these human rights violations did not start at the time of partition in Kashmir. Kashmir was a princely state. It was a princely kingdom in the 19th century. And the oppression actually began then. So this is more than a century old conflict and more than a century old saga of terrible human rights violations. The human rights violations have many dimensions. So it's a multi-dimensional disaster, including historical, geopolitical, humanitarian, and moral. So I would like to bring some audiovisual aids because I could go over a million individual stories, but really I couldn't because my heart breaks to even talk about these atrocities. But I would like to bring these numbers because nowadays figures, really speak louder than words, and numbers seem to matter so much more than human lives and tears. So I would like to bring this chart to attention. And as you can see, this is from January of 1989 to December of 21st of 2016. And we have over 100,000 killings. And there's a breakdown of the different kinds of human rights violations over there. So it is kind of self-explanatory. I'm not going to waste time going over this, but I will say this, that people in the audience might be wondering that, hey, what happened before and what happened after? Well, I'll tell you what happened before. We have statistics that say since before 1947, like I said, this oppression started before 1947 till date, we have numbers saying that more than 500,000 people have been massacred in the Kashmiri conflict. More than 500,000, I repeat. Can we go slowly, brothers, in the charts? Yeah, so I'm still on the first one. So, and then what happened after? The question is, what happened after 2016? I'll tell you the answer to that too. Well, guess what? Human rights organizations are not given free access. So if India is true to its word and it says, hey, they're doing this to uplift the Kashmiris, why don't they open their doors and welcome human rights organizations to see the wonderful work they're doing to uplift people of the valley? They're not. And what speaks for itself is, yeah, let's go to the next chart before I speak further. So this speaks for itself. And then this one is about the different types of, acts of aggression that Kashmiris have been facing. I will call attention upon the 48% over here, where it says 48% Kashmiris think they are not safe. And I really found this very interesting because that number, it reflects truth. Because you know why? The people of Kashmir are so apprehensive about sharing their thoughts that only 48% felt comfortable enough to voice their fear and the sufferings that they were facing. So that really speaks a lot. And that apprehension, believe me, is even till this date and even in this country. Many people are scared even to come up onto social media and voice their opinion. So next slide, brothers. So we have this pie diagram over here that tells you a breakdown of the types of Indian aggression that is taking place on the civilians as we speak. And this number, this pie chart, as you can see, it is outdated again for the same reason, because ever since, we'll talk about August 5th, 2019, all these statistics altered drastically. So everything was increased to a new level of aggression. And I will call upon attention on this disappearance. So in August of 2019, and I want to actually backtrack a little bit on what happened on that day. So we'll go to the first, to the last diagram before I go on to details of what happened on August 5th. Yeah, so this one is, again, a breakdown. It's an old breakdown about, the different kinds of casualties. And I wanted to bring this to attention is because militants is a word that is often used. I think this is it's a misnomer, because standing up for your rights and standing up for a legitimate right that has been highlighted even in the United Nations, that the people of Kashmir have been endowed or have been bestowed the right of self-determination. And this is not something that, has just been conjectured. This is something that is in black and white, and they're asking for that right. And you call them militants just because they're asking for something that's a legitimate right. So please, people, no using that word. It's people who are standing up for their rights, or freedom fighters, if you can call them. So after this, I would like to bring to attention something else that's not even charted in these charts. Two things. And this I have inferred from talking to people who are suffering on the ground as we speak. Humiliation and harassment. There's no pie chart or bar diagram or statistics to relate those statistics. The amount of humiliation and harassment that is taking place even to this day, even of healthcare professionals, my colleagues, I talked to them about what they're facing right now. And they told me that when they go to work, they are stopped unnecessarily by the military and they're asked why they're going out and where they're going, and just unnecessary harassment. So what happened on August 5th is a big question. So already so much oppression and aggression was taking place. On August 5th, 2019, all this reached a new dimension. People woke up in the morning and their internet was knocked out. Their landlines weren't working. They opened their windows and there are 1 million troops stationed in the valley. And another thing I would like people, I don't know how much of the audience knows about the population of Jammu and Kashmir. The Jammu Kashmir and Kashmir population currently is around 13 million. The people in the valley are about 7 million. So 1 million troops were deployed. So this civilian to army ratio is about 7:1. If they were doing some wonderful act, why did they have to deploy armed forces to do this act of so-called upliftment? Then two more things were implemented on August 5th, which took this aggression to new heights. Two things. PSA, which is the Public Service Act, according to which the armed forces were able to imprison, not only imprison, even minors. We have kids as young as 9-year-old who were whisked off from their family in the middle of the night and taken to jails, not just in Kashmir, but also in Agra. And I have firsthand reports of the conditions of those jails. They're the worst possible cells that you can imagine. 9-year-olds were taken there under the Public Services Act. And the Special Protection Act was the other thing. So the PSA, Public Safety Act, and the SPA, the Special Protection Act, according to which the armed forces had complete immunity. So they could do as they please, and there would be nobody to question their acts of terrorism. So everything reached new heights on August 5th. And one more thing I would like to say before we go on to the next thing is that there were some other webinars being held, and I'm not trying to point fingers on them, but I mean, excuse me, you're still questioning that this is a genocide? Let's get real here. There's no question that this is a genocide. In fact, it's not only is it a genocide that is an active one, it is also a passive genocide. And I'll explain that more when we go further into this.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Sabine. And we'll come back to the situation on the ground, how we are receiving news and all of that. But let's go back to Dr. Kanjwal for a question that's, if you can talk to us about, India's claim that Kashmir is an integral part of India. And what are, some of the long-term issues that has been on the ground in that regard? Not merely, this is not an issue that just came to be because of the Modi government or the rising Hindu nationalism in India. And in connection to that question, I wanted to bring the Indian-Pakistani sort of, tension, so to speak. And if you can reflect on whether Indian Muslims who live in India, a huge number, and whether Pakistani Muslims, do they weave Kashmir from similar lenses? Is there a significant degree of overlap, or is there a divergence of views between Muslims living in India and Muslims living in Pakistan?
Yeah, thank you so much for those questions. So in terms of India's claim, of Kashmir being its integral part, it has kind of repeated that claim over and over again until it's almost humorous now at this part, at this point. And the fact that this is an issue that is on the UN agenda, has not been addressed for 72 years. The fact that to this day, Kashmiris have not forgotten that they have a right to self-determination, and that India has to do so much work. I mean, if I tell you the kinds of things India has to do to suppress dissent in Kashmir, you will be shocked. It's not just the different human rights violations, the enforced disappearances, arrests, everything. I mean, just they're even trying to essentially control people's thought processes and how they express themselves. The media, what you can say on social, you know, on different social media, things like that. Every single aspect of surveillance and trying to control a people, India is putting that into action. So then when it says Kashmir is its integral part, it's just, I mean, it's laughable. So not only is it not its integral part, just in terms of the very lived realities of Kashmiris, but also legally, it's not integral. The area is still disputed. India claims that because the Maharaja Hari Singh, you know, so-called acceded to India, that's its legal claim over the region. But as I already mentioned, he really had no power to do so. He'd lost control of the region. And I forgot to mention in the earlier historical part that a genocide had already taken place in 1947, not in the Kashmir Valley, but in Jammu, which was at that time majority Muslim, and had risen up against the ruler. And he quashed that pretty brutally. 250,000 people are said to have been killed, and another 250,000 were exiled to Pakistan, what's today's Pakistan. And that was also done with the help of right-wing Hindutva militias at the time that were connected to the RSS. So this, you know, this longer history of both Hindu nationalists, but also liberal secular Indian oppression exists in Kashmir. And for both of them, there's some similarities, interestingly. For Hindu nationalists, they see Kashmir as integral to their idea of an Akhund Bharat, their territorial imagination of what a Hindu homeland looks like. And interestingly, it's not just over the Indian nation state as we see today, which includes Kashmir, but that Hindu homeland also includes Pakistan, parts of Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. So it's like, you know, that's their geographical imagination. And so the way in which Kashmir is situated, if you think about, I wish I had this image, but there's a Hindu goddess that's kind of superimposed on the map of the subcontinent. Kashmir is the head of that goddess. So imagine for them, if you take away that head, you know, that's what Kashmir means to them. It's central to that. And this is a claim that they've had. This is not for centuries, but for the duration of their existence. And for secular India, you know, because it's still dealing with the aftermath of partition, even 72 years later, India has tried to claim that, you know, because we have this Muslim majority state, that means that we are secular. Let's forget about how we actually treat that so-called Muslim majority state. But it was, you know, it's almost as if having Kashmir part of India allows India to kind of push back on Pakistan for saying that we needed a Muslim state, right? Because our interests as Muslims, who would always be a minority in the Indian subcontinent, would not be protected in whatever, you know, the Indian National Congress and Nehru and the founders of India had envisioned. So they're, you know, both of them have that claim, but territorially, in terms of how they see Kashmir, there's significant overlaps. In terms of your second question about Indian Muslims and Pakistani Muslims, so, you know, this is a difficult question. For Indian Muslims, I think, are in a really difficult position. On the whole, they have not really supported Kashmir. I'll be honest with you about that. In fact, a number of prominent leaders, Indian Muslim leaders, have supported what their state is doing to Kashmir. And part of it, I think, on their end, trying to understand their psyche is survival, right? Because what the fear always was is that if this Muslim majority region does go to Pakistan, or if it gets its independence or whatever, what is going to be the fate of, you know, the 400 million Indian Muslims? So they have always felt insecure as a result of that. And so, you know, either there's like silence because they're afraid, they may feel some sympathies with what people are going through, but, you know, they can't really say or do much about it. Or there's active abetting in what the Indian state is doing. In terms of the diaspora here, what I've noticed since the last year is, yes, on many levels, there is some kind of overlap between the concerns that Kashmiri Muslims may have and that Indian Muslims may have about the rise of the RSS and Hindu nationalism in India. But there's also like a very, like there's a breaking point, to the extent that for them, they see themselves as Indian citizens. And as part, you know, that they want to kind of turn India back to a kind of secular state, which from our perspective, it never was. And, you know, from my perspective as an academic, it never really was. But they still hold on to that hope. But for Kashmiri Muslims, they don't have that hope of India either being secular or democratic. And so the idea is that, you know, they don't see themselves as part of that state. So there's that division that also emerges in the diaspora. As for Pakistani Muslims, you know, Pakistan is an active, it has a lot at stake in Kashmir. It's a party to the dispute. The Pakistan state, regardless of the actions of the Pakistan state, I think the Pakistani people have always expressed their solidarity with Kashmir, and they feel very strongly about Kashmir. And part of it is, they have their own claims that, you know, they feel that in 1947, it should have gone to Pakistan. And so what was done at that time was wrong, and they're trying to kind of reclaim that. I think there will always be like very strong feelings of solidarity that Pakistani Muslims have for Kashmir. But, I guess it's important to foreground primarily what the Kashmiris want, and to listen to them, and to, you know, whether it is an independent state or whether it is to merge with Pakistan, that sentiment certainly exists as well. Like that is what's important. But there's definitely very different perspectives that Indian Muslims and Pakistani Muslims have.
Thank you, Dr. Hafsa, for an excellent answer. Hopefully we would like to see Kashmir as an independent country someday. That's one of the wish. But talking about the current situation of COVID-19, and what are some challenges were presented to Kashmiris during this double lockdown, right? We know that Kashmiris knew what the lockdown means, right? Started for them well before we went for lockdown for a pandemic. And how is the healthcare being implemented in the Kashmir Valley, especially in the setting of pandemic? This is for Dr. Sabina.
Yes, thank you for the question. So let me just backtrack a little bit. So let's see what the starting situation is before COVID-19 comes on the stage, so to speak. So just to start off with, healthcare system was not the best in Kashmir because Kashmir has been neglected to a large extent, neglected and abused to a large extent. It had so much potential, and yet the lovable Indian government, who cares so much about its integral part, Kashmir, and the Kashmiris, they did not do much to enhance the region, and they did not care about the health of the people, because for all they cared, you know, the place could be just land and all the Kashmiris could perish very conveniently. So healthcare delivery and healthcare system to start off with wasn't very efficient. Doctors had to face numerous difficulties right from the get-go. So what happens when before COVID-19, another thing happened. The August 5th, the revocation of Article 370 happened. And that brought down paralysis of the communication system and the internet. So we all know, just the other day we had a power outage and we didn't have internet for just a few hours. And believe me, my house and my kids were on the verge of a nervous breakdown. But the Kashmiris, being resilient as they are, for months after months, they stayed without internet connection. So you can imagine what that did to the delivery of healthcare. And we all know, because we all know communication is key in any sector, and especially the healthcare sector. So because of the lack of internet and communication, people were not able to get basic life services. Like an example of that would be dialysis. People who are on dialysis 2 to 3 times a week had to miss sessions because it was not possible to get it without any internet connection and, you know, with the way the lockdown was imposed from August 5th onwards. The other thing is that there was a mismatch between the supply and demand. So now COVID-19 comes into this already imposed lockdown, that is completely brutal. And then we have COVID-19. Here we're trying to deal with just COVID-19 and we're trying to come to terms with that. But Kashmiris already had this added insult of August 5th. So in that setting, COVID-19 comes into play. And now we have a mismatch. And these are latest figures that I'm giving you. I'm going to give you just now. My colleagues who are in Kashmir just told me 2 days ago that something as simple as oxygen we're talking about. We're living in the 21st century in a so-called developed and educated world. Oxygen, there is a mismatch between the demand and the supply of 3:1. Can you believe that? So that's something as basic as that. And then coming to the issue of antivirals, you know that remdesivir is one of the medications that has been proven to be effective. There's a dearth of supply of that. Plasma exchange, another thing that has proven to be very beneficial in some cases of people being afflicted by COVID-19. There is no integrated database where, you know, people are like, hey, we want to donate, we want to give it, but there's no integration of the system where, you know, they can go to some focal point and provide that service. And then something as basic as masks. So we're talking about all this and then we talk about PPE and masks. So, you know, there is, this is actually a very interesting topic and we could spend a whole hour on this, but I'll try to cut it short. The Kashmiris were very apprehensive about using it. And, you know, at first I was like, you know, why aren't they doing it? You know, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. Prevention is better than cure. And here we are sending out these videos, you know, to the local population in their own words by people, you know, who are trustworthy. I was like, why aren't they doing it? And then I thought to myself, I was like, you're telling a person who is being brutalized, whose kids are being dragged out of their beds in the middle of the night and sent to, you know, places in India, and subject to unspeakable torture. I cannot even start giving you accounts of what these Indians are doing to our innocent children. And you tell that person, hey, wear a mask and you will protect yourself? I mean, give me a break. You know, who are we kidding here? These people have an extreme level of mistrust and I don't blame them. You know, they're ready to, they face much bigger evils. They're not scared of COVID-19. And just before I forget, and get carried away, I would like to point out the fact that just 10 days ago, I had to face a very challenging time. My colleague, my batchmate from Kashmir, an extremely hardworking and dedicated professional, he succumbed to COVID-19. And he became another martyr out of the tens and hundreds of thousands of martyrs. And I was trying to, you know, find out what had happened. And this gentleman living in Pulwama district, and we know all know, Hafsa, I'm sure, knows very well that Pulwama is one of the areas that has been very hard hit by the Indian army. And they have committed a lot of atrocities over there. This gentleman had put up a board saying free consultation. He was free consultation. He was seeing people back to back. The workflow was unimaginable. I mean, you know, how much can a person take, you know? And he you know, he's obviously he's in a much better place at this time. So it's beyond our comprehension. Healthcare delivery is an uphill task over there, and especially after August 5th, and especially after COVID-19. And one more thing I would like to say before we go to the next aspect is something that gets overlooked a lot, and it's very, very rampant. Not just here, in fact, I'm seeing cases over here too, but imagine the level of PTSD back in Kashmir. So, and one thing I would like to bring to the platform, and especially for people who are the oppressors back home, I would like to bring something to their attention. So PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is something that not only the oppressed face, okay? The oppressors, mind you, the oppressors also face it at a very large, to a very large extent. And I've actually seen people, I've seen Vietnam War vets who have been completely crippled by this, you know? And I know there are cases mm-hmm. of people who committed human rights violations in Kashmir, and this is over 2 decades ago. This is before, you know, the atrocities reached a new level. They went back home, and believe me, a lot of them committed suicide. So please, the Indian government, do yourselves a favor And please, you know, your nationalistic views, please, you know, rescue your own population first before you come to rescue Kashmiris. And yeah, not to mention the people who are living on the road and hardly have a bite to eat. Please, please think about their nationalistic interests.
Thank you, Dr. Sabina. Next question is for Professor Hapsar real quickly. Can you give us some a quick summary of the Kashmiri community in the United States, the demographics when they arrived here first?
Yeah, sure. So there were a number of Kashmiris that went, that studied in US universities. I think one as early as the 1930s or something, maybe one or two at that time. Many came in the 1950s, but it was, as with much of the other South Asian diaspora, after the Immigration Act, I believe, of 1965, that, you know, as, you know, many American Muslims came from different countries in the Middle East and South Asia. Many of them came at that time as well. And of this group, there were those who came primarily for, you know, they were doctors or engineers, and so they wanted to settle and work here for greater economic opportunity. But even at that time, there were people who were in many ways political exilees. So they had been active in politics in Kashmir in resisting the Indian state or calling for a plebiscite. And they had been, you know, targeted there. And so they came to the US as a result. And since then, you know, our elders have been a part of the American Muslim community, the fabric of many of the institutions that were started in the 60s and the 70s, and have been very active in that. And in 1990, they started an organization that was, you know, the Kashmir American Council to address what was happening with the armed rebellion there and to kind of lobby on the issue of Kashmir. And in the 90s, I think another wave of people came. That's when my family came to escape, you know, the immense human rights violations and situation that had been there at that time. And since that time, people have kind of trickled in, mostly just because there's so little opportunity in Kashmir and, you know, for better education, employment, and so on. So it's a very skilled, I would say highly skilled diaspora, fairly elite as well, which has resulted, I guess, for quite a bit of time, not amongst all people, but many people, a bit of a, I would say, like a inactivity in terms of what was going on back home. I think many people were kind of chasing the American dream, as with many other communities. But since, you know, there have been these moments, 2008, 2010, 2016, where people would gather together. There have been different humanitarian efforts with education or healthcare that were started to, you know, bring some of that talent back to Kashmir. But I think it was really since last August when they kind of were shaken to their core and realized that, yes, there's this place that they know and they go back to every summer, but that very place might not be, you know, what they're used to anymore. And their families are completely under assault there. Even elite families or even educated families, right? Because so much of this occupation has, it's the middle class, the lower class that has borne the brunt of it. They have been the ones who've been at the forefront resisting, while many of the elite families have collaborated with the Indian state. And there is, unfortunately, as with other areas, a class of collaborators that exist. But now, in many ways, all of them are under danger. So I think that activism has certainly increased in the past year, but it will definitely need to be a lot more in order to really develop a strong lobby that can support Kashmir in the US. And I do want to add to that, to this point, that we're also dealing with an extremely resourceful and organized Indian lobby. And we know that one of the things that Kashmiris have tried to do is get a resolution passed in the US Congress that denounces India's human rights violations. It's very mild. It doesn't even talk about the right to self-determination. Just talks about prisoners, detainees, healthcare, I think, and religious freedom, communication. And India worked so hard just to make sure that that resolution doesn't even see the light of the day. So, you know, and our community is very, very small. Just, you know, a couple thousand people in the US. So for us to be really able to take on the Indian state, not just in Kashmir, but also here, we certainly need the support of of our allies of other communities.
Wonderful. So I wanted to ask a connected question, actually, just as a follow-up, Dr. Hafsa, about this, which kind of, you know, connects to how Indian Americans in the United States are reacting or are following really what's going on the ground. Is there, you know, that's propaganda in an election year? We know that there is now even heightened attention on the Indian American sort of political activity, with the VP, one of the candidates being from that background. But also, you know, connected to that, an issue that you alluded to earlier, right? So you said that it's not only the religious Hindu fanatics who have been, you know, guilty of what's going on in Kashmir, but also liberal secular groups as well. So that nationalism or that discourse has broader buy-in. You know, has there been any groups, political groups within the non-Muslim political spectrum in India that have been voicing the voice of reason and the voice of conscience when it comes to Kashmir? That's one question. And then a connected question to that is, what are some ways that the Modi government and maybe others even have used the war on terror discourse, the Muslim extremism discourse, and have bought into the post 9/11 discursive landscape that has impacted American Muslims as well? So I guess there are three questions there, one being the Indian Americans here in the United States, to what extent they are being impacted or they are being influenced by the discourse in India. Mm-hmm. Second being, you know, the Indian political spectrum, and then third, the connection of these two to this post 9/11 war on terror, Islamophobia, all Muslims are violent kind of discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the Indian American community, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that for the most part, either they are Hindu nationalists or soft Hindu nationalists is really the only way to describe it. There's a lot of money that goes from the US, from the Indian diaspora in the US to promote and support Hindu nationalism in India and elsewhere. It's an extremely resourced group of people. In terms of how they responded, it's really interesting. They actually, you know, I think a lot of Indian American organizations were active mostly on like India, US, like nuclear deals or defense deals. They wanted to make sure that, especially in the 90s and the 2000s, that as the US was pivoting away from Afghanistan and Pakistan and seeing India as an ally, especially in terms of defense and the war on terror. So Indian American community was very active in making sure that the policies that were being implemented were pro-India, pro-Indian business, pro-Indian defense, and so on. And I think that is one avenue that any kind of activism on this issue will need to tackle. But they have very strong support from both the Republican and the Democratic establishment. Even, you know, some of the statements that have been made by some of the Democrats have been very mild, just kind of stick, like the issue that a lot of people seem to care about is religious freedom. And so, yes, that, you know, certain Muslims are being targeted within India, Christians, Dalits, and so on. It's a lot less, you know, about India's settler colonial project in Kashmir. No one at this point has really articulated it as such. And that is the reality of what it is. So yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with this kind of back and forth between those who are so clearly Modi, RSS, Hindu nationalists, and those who are kind of trying to put up this veneer of being liberal and secular, and are doing a pretty poor job of it. I think the most that we'll get out of them is that, yes, you know, maybe this article revocation was not a good idea, and maybe, you know, human rights should be restored, but they will never go far as to say that this is an issue that's an international dispute and it, you know, needs a resolution. They will continually kind of say the same stuff about Kashmir being integral to India. And different groups in the US have operated within this framework and have actually been mobilized, remobilized. They're remobilized both on the political front with the Hindu America Foundation, which is an extremely troubling organization, but also in campuses with the Hindu Students Council. They bring in different, you know, Hindutva speakers to kind of, again, push the narrative that India is doing great things in Kashmir and elsewhere. So that's but I will also say, though, that in the past, year, I have seen quite a few progressive Indians or Indians who might be more aligned to the left change. Like before, I would say all of them were for what the Indian state was doing. And now I see more of them question what India is doing and be a lot more open, especially in the younger kind of millennial Gen Z generation. Mm-hmm. So I do see that like as one place of hope in general. Within the Indian political establishment, the more left-wing bodies or entities may speak up about human rights in Kashmir, but they don't go so far as to actually challenge their Indian state's narrative on Kashmir. So there is always that limitation, although, you know, to a certain extent, it might also be changing in smaller circles. But given the level of suppression that exists even in any kind of dissent against the Modi project in India, it's going to be very hard and increasingly harder for Indians to even express any kind of solidarity on Kashmir in the future. And as for the war on terror, I mean, absolutely, 9/11, one of the things that it unfortunately did was paint this, what, you know, Sabina mentioned earlier, a very kind of legitimate self-determination movement as one of terrorism. And India is able to, you know, use that language to completely undercut any discussion of what's happening, and also paint this bogey of Islamic radicalism that, oh, this movement is not actually about self-determination, it's actually about creating an ISIS-like state in Kashmir, which is, you know, completely Islamophobic and bogus. And one of the things that's also really important to mention here is that Indian counterinsurgency efforts in Kashmir have actually, like they do in, you know, like the US state does as well, have kind of enable situations where certain attacks may take place. So a lot of the things that they claim are being done by, you know, these militants may be done at the behest of the Indian state just to completely undermine this movement as one that's legitimate. And one of the ways they do this is to divide the religious communities in Kashmir against each other. So whether it's Muslims and Sikhs, Muslims and Buddhists, Muslims and Hindus. And they've done this not just since 9/11, but even when the armed rebellion began. So I think that's really important for people to understand is when we talk about the war on terror, we never actually talk about the role of the state in creating that kind of atmosphere and then enabling it and then undermining legitimate movements for self-determination or freedom. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. So we want to take a question here from one of our audience members, Brother Shams al-Huda from North Bend Mosque. He asks a question, and I think that will be a good segue into the conclusion of our program, where we want to talk about what can everyday community members here in the United States can do. And the question is, how would our Kashmiri diaspora in the United States like the Kashmir issue resolved, pragmatically speaking? So whether the bills in the Congress, you know, are considering certain limitations and all of that, maybe we can start briefly with Dr. Sabina.
Yes, very good question, because, you know, we can go on all day about talking about how Indian barbarism is showing itself in Kashmir and all over India. But yes, how do we fix this problem is the bigger issue. So one thing I would like to bring to the attention of our enlightened political representatives over here in this country, because I'm a US citizen, and you know, this issue has actually become even more traumatic for me after becoming a Kashmiri American, because I would really like to say this before I go on to answer this question further, is that, you know, we claim ourselves to be the champion of human rights all over the world. And I've actually had another, you know, good fortune of living in one part of the world, I won't take any names, where the American government actually went as far as to impose economic sanctions and airstrikes, okay? Economic sanctions and airstrikes, and I was a survivor. That's why I'm here today. How many, 30 years later? I'm here as a survivor to speak about that event. So, you know, we claim to be, you know, very idealistic when it comes to our old interests. But people of Kashmir, we don't have any ulterior motives there, so we just conveniently brush it under the carpet. I have news for you people who are supporting India. think about it. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. People who do not respect their own constitution, demolish it, who demolish places of worship, who have no regard for religious sanctity, irrespective of which religion you are from. Remember, God is the same for everybody, despite what your beliefs are. People who are breaking their own constitution, people who are waging war with the Almighty, you are making allies out of them? Congratulations. My fears are that not only is Kashmir in peril, which it has been for such a long time, my concerns, and these concerns have been going on way before August 5th, is that that terrorism which India is subjecting Kashmiris to is now spilling over in this country. And believe me, I have seen it in many sectors. Even in the healthcare sector, I have seen people who are trying to invade our noble constitution in this country. And this is another apprehension that I have. So I'm not just worried about Kashmir. I'm worried about the United States. So anybody who decides to make these people, you know, who have the big bucks, their allies, please keep these things in mind before you continue those friendships. So now talking about how we can do this, how we can fix things, you know, what are the solutions to these problems? First and foremost, highlight the truth via speeches, protests, rallies, webinars. Oh my God, social media is out there. And you guys have Facebook. I'm not on Facebook, but for those who use it, do use it. Don't misuse it. Use it. And that way you can reach the wider audience. Second thing, cleansing minds and goal orientation in various groups and group chats. So we have all these WhatsApp groups, and I've seen myself firsthand, there are going to be elements in there who are trying to weigh you down. You know, they're trying to dilute your cause. Make sure that those elements do not gain the majority and that we nip the evil in the bud, okay? Third thing, redirecting resources and rethought. So if anybody starts to, you know, say, oh, it's the end of the world, we're done for, oh my God, no. Our religion preaches that, and most religions, you know, they preach that you should never give up, you should never be disheartened. So we will continue our faith till our last breath and beyond. Another thing, enlightenment of our political representatives here via group meetings, because a lot of them, you know, you have to give them the benefit of the doubt. They don't have too much knowledge about, you know, one part of the world, you know, 30 million people suffering in Kashmir. So educate them in a nice way. So face-to-face encounters, letters, phone calls, we've been doing that. We've had a lot of one-on-one conversations with different people. Then involvement on the ground. Involvement of the ground is very important because, you know, we can talk all we want, we can have a million webinars, but people who are suffering in Kashmir, we need to have a way to reach them. And, you know, the Indian tyranny is so, articulate that they are trying to cordon off any help even reaching the Kashmiris, leave alone their voice reaching the rest of the world. They're trying to sever ties, between the Kashmiri population and the rest of the world. And it's becoming a hassle for, you know, these humanitarian organizations to get the help to Kashmir. But believe me, even in these difficult times, there are people who are able to do that with God's grace. And so it's very important to, join hands with those organizations. And they have projects like healthcare delivery. And if anybody's interested, they can reach out and find out. Kashmir is one of the organizations that's doing a phenomenal job on the ground, healthcare delivery for all people, you know. One thing I would really like to say here is that despite all this, propaganda against our religion, we still, respect all religions in the valley, even in this day. In fact, all this propaganda that India is trying to create, the hostility and the hatred in our hearts, we are actually, our love for each other and each other religions has actually increased since then. So, you know, mm-hmm. Go ahead trying to divide us because it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So just one more thing. Healthcare delivery, educational, vocational training, and rehabilitation. So these are things that we can really help the on-ground population by joining hands with these organizations. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, thank you so much. Yeah, Brother Abil, over to you. We are not hearing you currently.
Sorry, I was on mute. I said we have to wrap this up quickly as we just heard the Maghrib Azan. But before you go, I have a question for Professor Hafsa, then we can close it. So how can everyday community member contribute to the Kashmiri cause? Do you think American media and public have a solid grasp of the ongoing realities on the ground? The most important question, do we expect to see a change in Kashmir with the potential leadership change here in the United States in November?
Okay. I actually wanted to answer Brother Shamsul Huda's question about how the Kashmiri diaspora would like the issue to be resolved, because I think that's important. You know, I think it's like very simple. The region needs to be demilitarized. Kashmiris have to be at the table of any kind of decision-making process between India and Pakistan, and which Pakistan is committed to. Pakistan has always said that it believes in the right to self-determination, and there needs to be some kind of referendum. And whether you treat the whole region as one, or you kind of divide it, and, you know, I mean, I would like to still see a united Kashmir, but, you know, there's multiple options just given the demographics of the whole place, of what could potentially happen. But what is just not good is that the present scenario, the status quo, cannot be, it should not continue. But in terms of everyday, I think Dr. Sabina did a really good job of kind of highlighting both kind of education, grassroots advocacy, political advocacy, the use of social media. We are hoping that at some point there will be some kind of boycott campaign that individuals can get involved with, but also that communities can get involved with. There are a lot of Indian business interests in the US. A lot of them are also linked to, you know, the RSS and the Hindu nationalist movement. So I think educating yourselves on where exactly Indian power, whether it's soft or hard power, is, you know, exists in your communities, and trying to push back, trying to encourage some kind of boycott, divestment process. I think that's where the future of hopefully this movement and mobilization will go. And just to give you one example, for like Google, for example, has a very strong relationship with the Indian government. And so, you know, for those people who are in the tech industry, of which, you know, we have quite a few in the American Muslim community, why not use your resources and your connections to do something about that? And there's, you know, thousands more examples like that across universities, businesses, and so on. So you asked about and I think education is really important. Like, I'm really impressed that, you know, for an issue that never got any say, whether it's in the media or in our campuses or anything, in the past year, the narrative around Kashmir has changed so much. The fact that, you know, even my students, when I would teach them and I would say, like, anyone know about Kashmir, and they'd kind of look at me blankly, since last August in my teaching, like, the amount of media attention it's received, people do know that this place exists and something wrong is going on there, but they might not know the details. So the more that you can educate people, the more opportunities arise for some kind of activism or action. And the question about the Biden, you know, Trump and Modi are obviously very close, and, you know, there's no hope for that administration. I would say largely skeptical of what's possible within a Biden administration, although I do think that if there are enough mobilizations, grassroots mobilizations by communities on the ground, potentially something could change. I think at the most we'll get kind of a word of caution to the Indian regime. But I don't, you know, at this point, I don't necessarily expect any kind of sanctions or harder actions than that. But I think that if there is enough pressure by communities, something is possible. And that pressure is really important, I think, where grassroots advocacy amongst different movements needs to come into play. So for me, I never saw Kashmir as an issue that's isolated. I always saw it as connected to Palestine, as always connected to other kind of global Muslim solidarity struggles that we are dealing with. And I think we need to kind of develop a kind of American Muslim politics that is a lot more bold in terms of what it's asking for, and really pushing the needle towards, you know, being a lot more representative of these causes.
Thank you so much. So I think, you know, this brings us to the end of our program, and I want to thank both of you. It's rare that we have such clarity and such passion together. So I'm really grateful. We are grateful to you both for giving your voice, for giving your knowledge, for giving your experience and your passion to this program. One reminder is that the program will be continue to be available on our Facebook page and our web pages. So please be on the look. If you know of individuals who can benefit from this, kindly share along so that hopefully it reaches broader audiences. And on that note, hopefully with enough involvement and enough passion and enough energy channeled into all of these struggles and all of these issues, we will hopefully have some positive impact in the short and the long run. Brother Rabiul, anything from your end?
Nothing from my end, but what I will say is, as a minority Bangladeshi American, there is a two saying, if you're not on the menu, so you're not on the table, never going to be on the menu. So we need to get more active politically here in the United States. And one thing we have to keep in mind, like Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So that will be my closing sentence. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that. I am just seeing Jacob Bender, who's our executive director, raised hand. I don't know, Jacob, did you want to say a few things before you go? If so, you should be able to unmute and speak. And I'll use this opportunity to let everyone know that next Thursday, the 27th at 7 p.m., we'll have a similar webinar, this time on Syria and the crisis, the humanitarian crisis in Syria, with Suzanne Meriden of Syrian American Council and with Wale Zayed of Engage. So please save the date and be on the look for an announcement on that. But again, August 27th, Thursday at 7 p.m. Jacob, please.
Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you to our three team guests. Just wanted to remind people again about the program on Syria, which is next Thursday. So thank you all for participating in another of CARE's webinars in lieu of face-to-face meetings. Zoom has been a benefit to furthering education and community solidarity. So assalamu alaikum to all of you. Thank you very much for your participation.
If I may just request for one more announcement, which is that Brother Rabiul reminded me this Saturday at 4 p.m. we have an event on COVID-19 and back to school, talking about with school districts reopening and with COVID-19 still ongoing. We'll be joined by health experts, we'll be joined by school district officials, we'll be joined by some local politicians to talk around this, hopefully to give some guidance to us all and maybe brainstorm together. Again, it will be a Muslim Aid Initiative and CARE Philadelphia webinar this Saturday at 4 p.m. And I'll drop the link here for that program as well. Once again, many, many thanks, Dr. Hafsa Kanjwal. Many, many thanks, Dr. Sabina Fazli. We will definitely continue to amplify action and continue to amplify anything concrete that the community can take in regards to the Kashmir issue. But once again, thank you so much to everyone and have a great evening.
Thanks, everyone. Good night.